Special Contingent of Future Reinforcements, Commander Zheng Beihai reporting, Zheng Beihai said and saluted. Behind the commander of the Asian fleet flowed the brilliant Milky Way. Fleet Command was in orbit around Jupiter and rotated continuously to produce artificial gravity. Zheng Beihai noticed that the room lights were relatively dim, and the wide windows seemed intended to integrate the interior environment with space outside as closely as possible. The commander saluted back. "Greetings, predecessor." He looked quite young, his Asian features illuminated by the glow of his epaulettes and cap insignia. When he was issued a uniform on the sixth day after he reawakened, Zheng Beihai had noticed the familiar emblem of the Space Force, a silver star shining rays in four directions, the rays in the shape of a sword. 2 centuries had passed, and while the insignia had not changed much, the fleet had become an independent country, with a president as its supreme leader. The commander was just in charge of the military. Zheng Beihai said, "That's too much, Commander. We're all just new recruits now, who have to learn everything." The commander smiled and shook his head. "You can't say that. You've already learned everything there is to know here, and the knowledge you've got we'll never be able to learn. That's why we awakened you now." "Commander Cheng Wei Sir of the Chinese Special Force asked me to convey his greetings." Zheng Beihai's words touched something in the commander's heart. He turned and looked out through the window at the river of stars, like the upper reaches of a long river. "He was an exceptional general, one of the founders of the Asian fleet. Today's space strategy still uses the framework he established 2 centuries ago. I wish that he could have seen this day. Today's achievements are far beyond anything he ever dreamed. But all of this began in your time." Then Jupiter appeared, at first as a sliver of an arc that quickly took over the entire field of view in the window, bathing the office in its orange light. The dreamlike patterns of hydrogen and helium in its vast gaseous ocean were on a breathtaking scale and fascinating in their detail. The great red spot moved into view. The superstorm that could hold 2 Earths looked like the giant pupil-less eye of this blurry world. The 3 fleets had put their primary base on Jupiter because its hydrogen-helium ocean held an inexhaustible supply of fusion fuel. Zheng Beihai was transfixed by the Jovian scene. Countless times he had dreamed of the new domain that now presented itself before his eyes. He waited until Jupiter had moved out of the window before speaking. "Commander, the great achievements of this age are what make our mission unnecessary." The commander turned to him and said, "No, that's not right. The Future Reinforcement Plan was a far-sighted initiative. During the Great Ravine, when the Space Armed Forces were on the brink of collapse, the Special Reinforcement Contingents played a major role in stabilizing the overall situation."
"But our contingent arrived too late to be of assistance."
"I'm sorry, but that's how things are," the commander said. The lines on his face turned gentle. "After you left, they sent more special reinforcement contingents to the future, and the last to be sent out were the first to be reawakened."
"That's understandable, Commander, since their knowledge framework was closer to that era's."
"Right. Eventually, your contingent was the only one left in hibernation. The Great Ravine ended, and the world entered a period of rapid development. Defeatism had practically vanished, so there was no need to reawaken you. At the time, the fleet made the decision to keep you until the Doomsday Battle."
"Commander, this was actually what we all hoped for," Zheng Beihai said excitedly. and that's the highest honour of all space servicemen. They were well aware of this when they made that decision, but present circumstances are totally different, as you, of course, know. The commander pointed at the river of stars behind him. The doomsday battle might never even take place.
That's excellent, Commander. My small regret as a soldier counts for nothing compared with the great victory humanity is about to welcome. I just hope you'll be able to fulfill our one request, to let us join the fleet at the lowest level as ordinary soldiers to do whatever work we can.
The commander shook his head.
The length of service for all special contingent personnel will resume from the date of reawakening, and ranks will be elevated one or two levels.
Commander, that shouldn't be. We don't want to spend our remaining years in an office. We want to go to the fleet's front lines. 2 centuries ago, the Space Force was our dream. Without it, our lives have no meaning. But even at our present ranks, we are unqualified for work in the fleet.
I never said I wanted you to leave the fleet. Precisely the opposite. You will all be working in the fleet to complete a highly important mission.
Thank you, Commander. But what mission can there be for us today? The commander did not answer him. Instead, as if it had only just occurred to him, he said,
Are you okay with talking while standing like this?
The commander's office had no chairs, and the table had been designed to be high enough to work at while standing. Fleet Command's rotation produced 1/6 of Earth's gravity, which meant that there wasn't much difference between standing and sitting.
Zheng Beihai smiled and nodded.
Not a problem. I spent a year in space.
And the language? Do you have any communication problems in the fleet?
The commander was speaking standard Chinese, but the three fleets had formed a language of their own, similar to the modern Chinese and modern English on Earth, but with the two languages blended more closely. Chinese and English words each accounted for half of the vocabulary.
At first, mostly because I couldn't distinguish between Chinese and English vocabulary, but I was able to understand it pretty quickly. Speaking is more difficult.
That doesn't matter. If you just use English or Chinese when you speak, we'll be able to understand you. So that means that the General Staff Department has fully briefed you?
That's right. In the first few days on base, they gave us a comprehensive introduction to everything.
Then you must be aware of the mental seal.
That's right.
Recent investigations still haven't discovered any signs of the imprinted.
What's your read?
I believe that one possibility is that the imprinted have disappeared. Another possibility is that they've been deeply hidden. If a person has an ordinary defeatist mentality, they will speak of it to others. But a 100% unshakable, technologically hardened faith will inevitably produce a corresponding sense of mission. Defeatism and escapism are intimately related, and if the imprinted really exist, then their ultimate mission is bound to be accomplishing an escape into the universe. But to achieve this goal, they have to deeply conceal their true thoughts.
The commander nodded with approval.
An excellent analysis. This is the opinion of the General Staff.
Commander, the second alternative is very dangerous.
Yes, it is, particularly with the Trisolaran probe so close to the solar system. The fleet is divided by command system classifications into 2 major groups. The first, a distributed command system, is a traditional structure akin to the naval craft you once commanded. The captain's orders are carried out by various operating personnel. The second is a centralized command system. The captain's orders are carried out automatically by the ship's computer. The most recently built advanced space warships, as well as those currently under construction, fall into this category. It is mainly against this category of warship that the mental seal poses a threat. because the captain wields enormous power in the command system. He can unilaterally control when the ship leaves and returns to port, its speed and course, and even a large portion of its weapon systems. Under this command system, you could call the ship an extension of the captain's body. Right now, 179 of the 695 Stellar-class warships in the fleet have a centralized command system. The commanding officers on board these ships will be the focus of review. Originally, all the warships involved in the review process were supposed to be docked and sealed up, but present circumstances no longer permit this, because the three fleets are preparing to intercept the Trisolaran probe when it arrives. This will be the first actual engagement between the space fleet and the Trisolaran invaders, so all warships must be on standby. So, Commander, the command authority for centrally commanded warships must be turned over to reliable individuals, Zheng Beihai said. He had been speculating about his mission, but had not guessed it yet. Who is reliable? The commander asked. We don't know the extent of the mental seal, and we have no information about the imprinted. In these circumstances, no one can be trusted, not even me. The sun appeared outside the window. Although its light was far weaker than on Earth from this distance, the commander's body was hidden in a glare when the disc passed behind him, leaving only his voice. But you are all reliable. When you entered hibernation, the mental seal didn't exist. And one of the most important factors for your selection 2 centuries ago was your loyalty and faith. You are the only trustworthy group available to us in the fleet right now, so the fleet has decided to put the authority of the centralized command system into your hands, to appoint you as acting captains, through whom every order issued by the former captains must pass before being issued to the command system. 2 tiny suns ignited in Zheng Beihai's eyes. He said, "Commander, I'm afraid that's not possible."
"Saying no to an order is not our tradition."
The commander's use of "our" and "tradition" warmed Zheng Beihai, letting him know that the bloodline of the military of 2 centuries ago still endured in the space fleet of today. "Commander, we're from 2 centuries ago, after all. In the context of the navy of our time, it's like using an official in the Bei Yang fleet to command a 21st century destroyer."
"Do you think that the Qing admirals Deng Shichang and Liu Buchan would really be unable to command your destroyers?"
"They were educated and their English was good. They would have learned. Today, captaining a space warship doesn't involve technical details. Captains issue general commands, but the warship is a black box to them. Besides, the warships will be docked at base while you serve as acting captain. They won't be navigating. Your duty will be to convey the former captain's commands to the control systems once you've determined whether or not the commands are normal. You'll be able to pick that up as you learn."
"We'll have too much power in our hands. You could let the former captains retain a portion of that power, and we could supervise their orders."
"If you think about it carefully, you'll realize that won't work. If the imprinted really do occupy key battle positions, they'll take any necessary measures to evade your supervision, including assassinating their supervisors. A centrally supervised ship on standby requires just 3 commands to take off, after which it's too late to do anything. The system must only acknowledge commands from the acting captain." As the personnel craft flew past the Asian fleet's Jupiter base, Zheng Beihai felt he was flying over a range of towering mountains, except each was a docked warship. The naval base had entered nightside orbit around Jupiter, and the steel mountain clusters slept silently under the surface phosphorescence and the silvery moonlight from Europa overhead. A moment later, a ball of white light rose from the edge of the mountain range, lighting the moored ships in perfect clarity in an instant. To Zheng Beihai, it looked like a sunrise over the mountains, casting a moving shadow of the fleet upon the turbulent Jovian atmosphere down below. When a second light rose over the other side of the fleet, he realized it wasn't the sun, but two warships that were entering the dock and turning their fusion engines towards the base to decelerate. The fleet's chief of staff, who was delivering Zheng Beihai to his new post, told him that more than 400 warships, representing two-thirds of the Asian fleet, were now moored at the base. The remainder of the fleet's ships, now cruising the solar system and beyond, were also expected to return to port. Zheng Beihai had to tear himself away from the grand spectacle of the fleet and return to reality. "Sir, won't recalling all of the ships provoke any imprinted there are to immediate action?"
"No. The order recalling the ships was given for another reason. A real one, not an excuse, although it does sound a little ridiculous. You haven't been watching the news lately, I take it?"
"No, I've been reading materials on natural selection."
"Don't worry about that. You've got a good grasp of things, judging from the last phase of basic training. Your task now is to familiarize yourself with the systems to the point that everything can proceed in an orderly manner once you go aboard. It's not as hard as you think. Competition among the three fleets for the task of intercepting the Trisolaran probe has turned into bickering. But a preliminary agreement was hammered out by the joint conference yesterday. Each fleet's ships will assemble back at base. A special committee will supervise the execution of the manoeuvre to avoid any ships being dispatched without authorization to carry out the interception." "Why has it come to that? Any technological information and intelligence obtained from a successful interception would be shared."
"Yes, but it's a question of honour. There's considerable political capital to be gained by the fleet that makes first contact with Trisolaris. Why did I call it ridiculous? Because it's cheap and absolutely risk-free. The worst thing that could happen is if the probe self-destructs during the interception process, so everyone's gunning for it. If it was a battle with the main Trisolaran fleet, then all sides would try to preserve their strength. Politics today isn't all that different from your time. Look, there's natural selection."
As the personnel craft approached natural selection, and the sheer bulk of the Iron Mountain gradually became clear, the image of Tang floated up in Zheng Beihai's mind. Natural selection, comprised of a disc-shaped body and a separate cylindrical engine, looked entirely different from that sea-going aircraft carrier of two centuries before. When Tang met its untimely end, it was like he had lost his spiritual home, even though he had never moved in. Now, this giant spaceship gave him a new feeling of home. On Natural Selection's stalwart hull, his spirit found a place to live after two centuries of wandering, like a child enfolded in the embrace of some enormous power. Natural Selection was the flagship of the 3rd Squadron of the Asian Fleet. And in gross tonnage and performance, it was second to none. Possessing the latest non-media fusion propulsion system, at full thrust it could accelerate to 15% of the speed of light, and its impeccable internal ecological systems could sustain a long-term voyage. In fact, an experimental version of this system was first put into use on the Moon 75 years ago, and had not yet exhibited any major defects or faults. Natural Selection's weapons were the most powerful in the fleet, too. Its gamma-ray lasers, railguns, high-energy particle beams, and stellar torpedoes made up a four-way weapons system that could obliterate the surface of an Earth-sized planet. Natural Selection now occupied Zheng Beihai's entire field of view, so that only part of it was visible from the personnel craft. He noticed that the outer walls of the ship were mirror-smooth, a broad mirror that perfectly reflected the atmospheric ocean of Jupiter, as well as the gradual approach of the personnel craft. An oval opening appeared in the outer wall of the ship. The craft flew straight inside and came to a halt. The chief of staff opened the cabin door and exited first. Although Zheng Beihai was slightly nervous because he hadn't seen the craft pass through an airlock, he immediately sensed the influx of fresh air from the outside. The technology to maintain a pressurized compartment opening directly into space without allowing air to leak out was not something he had seen before. Zheng Beihai and the chief of staff were inside a giant sphere the diameter of a soccer field. Spaceship compartments typically adopted a spherical structure because during acceleration, deceleration, or change of direction, any point on the sphere could serve as a floor or ceiling, and during weightlessness, the centre of the sphere would be the crew's main activity space. In Zheng Beihai's time, cabins had been modelled on the structure of Earth buildings, so he was not at all used to this entirely new cabin structure. The chief of staff told him that this was the fighter hangar, but since there were no fighters right now, a formation of Natural Selection's 2,000 officers and soldiers was floating in the centre of the sphere. Before Zheng Beihai entered hibernation, National Space Forces had begun conducting drills in the weightlessness of space. They had developed specifications and drill books as a result, but implementation had been particularly difficult. Personnel could use their spacesuits' microthrusters to move about outside the cabin, but since they lacked propulsion equipment inside, they had to manoeuvre by pushing against bulkheads and paddling the air. Under such conditions, it was very difficult to form neat lines. Now he was astonished at the sight of more than 2,000 people floating in space in such a neat formation without any supports. These days, personnel moved through weightless cabins primarily by using magnetic belts, fabricated from superconductors and containing a circuit that generated a magnetic field that interacted with the magnetic field that was always present in the cabins and corridors of the spacecraft. With a tiny controller in hand, they could move freely inside the ship. Zheng Beihai was now putting on such a belt, but it would require skill to master. He watched the formation of space soldiers, a generation that had grown up in the fleet. Their tall, slender bodies had none of the clumsy sturdiness of people growing up under Earth's gravity, but possessed the light agility of spacers. Three officers were in front of the formation, and his gaze eventually rested on the young woman in the centre with four glittering stars on her shoulder. Natural Selection's captain, no doubt. A typical representative of new space humanity, taller even than Zheng Beihai, who was himself quite tall, she drifted easily over the formation, her slender body floating through space like an elegant musical note. When she reached Zheng Beihai and the chief of staff, she stopped, and the hair that had been floating behind her rippled around the fair skin of her neck. Her eyes were full of sunshine and vitality, and Zheng Beihai immediately trusted her, because the imprinted would never wear such an expression. "Dongfang Yang Shu, Captain of Natural Selection," she said, saluting him. A note of playful challenge appeared in her eyes. "On behalf of the entire crew, I offer a gift to my forebear." She extended her hand, and he saw that,
Although the object she held in it had changed quite a bit, it was still recognisably a pistol. "If you really find that I have defeatist thinking and escapist goals, you may use this to kill me."
Getting to the surface was easy. The trunk of every giant tree building was a pillar supporting the dome of the underground city, and from the trunk you could take an elevator directly to the surface, passing through more than 300 metres of rock. When Luo Ji and Shi Qiang exited the elevator, they felt nostalgic, a feeling prompted by one thing. The walls and floor of the exit hall did not have activated display windows. Information was displayed on actual display screens that hung from the ceiling. It looked like an old subway station, and most of the handful of people in it wore clothes that didn't flash. When they passed through the hall airlock, they were met by a hot wind blowing dusty air.
"There's my boy!"
Shi Qiang shouted, pointing at a man bounding up the steps. From this distance, Luo Ji could make out only that the man was in his 40s, so he was a little surprised at Shi Qiang's certainty. As Shi Qiang hurried down the steps to welcome his son, Luo Ji turned his eyes from the reunion to the surface world before him. The sky was yellow. He now realized why the image of the sky showing in the underground city was shot from a height of 10,000 meters, because from the ground, the sun was only visible as a hazy outline. Sand covered everything on the ground, and cars passed by on the street dragging dusty tails. It was another sight from the past for Luo Ji, cars that travelled on the ground. They didn't seem to run on gasoline. They came in all kinds of weird shapes, and some were new and some old, but they all shared one feature. Every car had a flat sheet installed on the roof, like an awning. Across the street he saw an old-era building with sand-covered windowsills and windows that were either boarded up or glassless black holes. However, people were evidently living in some of the rooms because he saw clothing hanging outside to dry and even some potted flowers on the windowsills. Though the airborne sand and dust kept visibility low, he soon located a couple of familiar building outlines further away and knew for certain that he was in the same city where he had spent half his life 2 centuries ago. He walked down the steps to the two men who were hugging and pounding each other in their excitement. Seeing the middle-aged man up close, he knew that Shi Qiang hadn't made a mistake.
"Dad, when you figure it, I'm only 5 years younger than you," Shi Xiaoming said, wiping tears from the corners of his eyes. "Not bad, kiddo. I was afraid some damn white-bearded old man would be calling me dad," Shi Qiang said with a chuckle. Then he introduced Luo Ji to his son.
"Oh, Dr. Luo, you used to be world famous," Shi Xiaoming said as he looked Luo Ji up and down.
The three of them headed toward Shi Xiaoming's car, which was parked at the side of the road. Before they got in, Luo Ji asked about the thing on the roof.
"It's an antenna. Up on the surface, we have to use whatever electricity leaks through from the underground city, so the antennas are a little larger, and the power is only enough to run the cars on the ground. They can't fly."
The car wasn't fast. Due either to the power or the sand on the road, Luo Ji looked out the window at the sandy city. He had a belly full of questions, but Shi Xiaoming and his father kept talking and he couldn't get a word in.
"Mum passed away in year 34 of the crisis. Me and your granddaughter were with her then." "Oh, good. You didn't bring my granddaughter with you?" "After the divorce, she went with her mum. I looked up her file. She lived into her 80s and died in year 105.
"Too bad I never met her.
How old were you when your sentence ended?
19.
What did you do then?
Everything. At first, with no other way out, I kept up the swindles, but then I did a bit of legitimate business. After I had the money, I saw the signs of the Great Ravine and went into hibernation. I didn't know then that things would get better later on. I just wanted to see you.
Is our house still there?
Land use rights were extended past the original 70-year period, but I only got to stay a short time before it was demolished. The one we bought later is still there, but I haven't been able to see it. Shi Xiaoming pointed outside. The city population isn't even 1% of what it was in our day. Do you know what the most worthless thing is? That house. You dedicated your entire life to it, Dad, but everything's empty now. You can live wherever you like. Finally, Luo Ji managed to seize a gap in their conversation to ask, Do all reawakened hibernators live in the old city?
No way. They live outside. There's too much sand in the city, but mostly it's because there's nothing to do. Of course, you can't go too far from the underground city or you can't get electricity. What do all of you do? Shi Qiang asked.
Think. What can we do that the kids can't?
Farming.
Shi Xiaoming, like other hibernators, no matter their age, had the habit of calling modern people kids. The car left the city and drove east. As the sand lessened to reveal the highway, Luo Ji recognized it as the old expressway between Beijing and Shijiazhuang, although both sides were piled high with sand now. The old building still stood there amid the sand, but what brought a spark of life to this desertified plain of northern China were the small oases ringed by sparse trees, which Shi Xiaoming said were hibernator settlements. They drove into one oasis, a small residential community surrounded by a sandbreak of trees that Shi Xiaoming called New Life Village No. 5. When he got out of the car, Luo Ji felt time flowing backward. Rows of six-story apartments fronted by open space, old men playing chess on stone tables, mothers pushing baby carriages, and a few children playing soccer on the sparse lawn growing on the sand. Shi Xiaoming lived on the sixth floor with a wife 9 years younger than him. She had entered hibernation in year 21 due to liver cancer, but was completely healthy now. They had a 4-year-old son who called Shi Qiang Grandpa. A sumptuous lunch had been laid out to welcome Luo Ji and Shi Qiang. Local farm produce, chicken and pork produced at other nearby farms, and even home-brewed alcohol. They called three of their neighbours to join them, three men who, like Shi Xiaoming, had entered hibernation relatively early, back when it was expensive and available only to rich members of the upper class or their sons and daughters. Now gathered here after a span of more than a century, they were all just ordinary people. Shi Xiaoming introduced one neighbour as Zheng Yan, the grandson of Zheng Yuanqiao, the man he had cheated back in the day.
Remember how you made me return the money I cheated him out of? I began the day I got out, and that's how I met Yan. He had just graduated from college. Taking inspiration from his two neighbours, we went into the funeral business and called our firm the High and Deep Company. High for space burials. We shot ashes into the solar system, and later on we were able to launch entire bodies. For a price, of course. Deep for mine burials. At first we used abandoned shafts, and later on we dug new ones, since they would work equally well as anti-Trisolaris tombs too. The man called Yan was a little older. He looked to be in his 50s or 60s.
Shi Xiaoming explained that Yan had been reawakened once before and lived for more than 30 years before going back into hibernation.
"What's our legal status here?" Luo Ji asked.
Shi Xiaoming said,
"Completely equivalent to modern residential areas. We count as the city's distant suburbs, and we have a proper district government. It's not just hibernators who live here. We also have modern people, and people from the city often come out here for fun."
Zhang Yan took over.
"We call the modern people wall tappers, because when they first get here, they're always touching the wall out of habit, trying to activate something."
"So life's okay?" Shi Qiang asked.
"They all said it was pretty good.
But along the road I saw the fields you plant. Can you really support yourselves by growing crops?"
"Why not? In the cities these days, agricultural products are luxury items. The government's actually quite good to hibernators. Even if you don't do anything, you can still live comfortably off government subsidies. But you've got to have something to do. The idea that hibernators all know how to farm is nonsense. No one was a farmer at first, but this is all we can do."
The conversation quickly turned to the history of the past 2 centuries.
"So what was the deal with the Great Ravine?" Luo Ji brought up the question he had long been wanting to ask.
Instantly, their faces grew serious. Seeing that the meal was almost over, Shi Xiaoming allowed the topic to continue.
"You've probably learned a little about it over the past few days. It's a long story. For more than a decade after you went into hibernation, life was pretty good. But later on, when the pace of economic transformation picked up, the standard of living declined by the day, and the political climate constricted. It really felt like wartime."
A neighbour said,
"It wasn't just a few countries. The entire earth was like that. Society was on edge, and if you said something wrong, they would say you were ETO or a traitor to humanity, so nobody felt safe. And film and television from the Golden Age began to be restricted, and then was banned worldwide. Of course, there was too much of it to ban effectively."
"Why?"
"They were afraid of eroding the fighting spirit," Shi Xiaoming said.
"Still, so long as there was food to eat, you could make do.
But later on, things got worse, and the world began to starve. This was about 20 years after Dr. Luo went into hibernation."
"Because of the economic transition?"
"Right, but environmental deterioration was also a major factor. The environmental laws were there, but in those pessimistic times, the general attitude was, what the hell is environmental protection for? Even if Earth turns into a garden, isn't it all going to the Trisolarans anyway? Eventually, environmental protection was seen as no less treasonous to humanity than the ETO. Organisations like Greenpeace were treated like ETO branches and suppressed. Work on the Space Forces accelerated the development of highly polluting heavy industry, which made environmental pollution unstoppable. The greenhouse effect, climate anomalies, desertification..." He sighed.
"When I entered hibernation, desertification was just starting,"
another neighbour said.
"It's not what you imagine, like the desert advancing from the Great Wall. No, it was patchwork erosion. Perfectly fine plots of land in the interior began turning to desert simultaneously, and it spread from those points, like how a damp cloth dries in the sun. Then agricultural production plummeted, and grain reserves were exhausted, and then came the Great Ravine."
"Did the prediction that the standard of living would go backward 100 years come true?" Luo Ji asked. Shi Xiaoming gave a few bitter chuckles.
"Oh, Dr. Luo, 100 years in your dreams. 100 years back from that time would have been around the 1930s or so. A paradise compared to the Great Ravine. No way the two are the same.
For one thing, there were so many more people than in the Great Depression, 8.3 billion. He pointed at Zhang Yan. He saw the Great Ravine when he reawakened for a while, you tell them. Zhang Yan drained his glass, eyes blank. He said, I have seen the Grand March of Hunger. Millions of people fleeing famine on the great plains through sand that blocked out the sky. Hot sky, hot earth, and hot sun. When they died, they were divided up on the spot. It was hell on earth. There are tons of videos to watch if you want. You think of that time, and you feel lucky to be alive. The Great Ravine lasted for about half a century, and in those 50-odd years, the world population dropped from 8.3 billion to 3.5 billion. Think about what that means. Luoji got up and went over to the window. From here, he could see the desert across the protective tree line, its yellow covering of sand extending silently to the horizon under the noonday sun. The hand of time had smoothed over everything.
And then? Shi Qiang asked.
Zhang Yan let out a long breath, as if no longer having to talk about that period of history had taken a burden off his shoulders. After that, well, some people came to terms with it, and then more and more people did. They wondered whether it was worth it to pay so high a price, even if it was for victory in the Doomsday Battle. Think about what's more important, the child dying of starvation in your arms or the continuation of human civilization. Right now, you might think the latter choice is more important. But you wouldn't have in that day and age. No matter what the future might bring, the present is most important. Of course, that mindset was outrageous at first, the classic thinking of a traitor to humanity. But you couldn't stop people from thinking it. And very soon the entire world thought so. There was a popular slogan back then, which soon became a famous historical quote. Make time for civilization, for civilization won't make time, Luo Ji contributed, without looking back from the window. Right, that one. Civilization is meant for us.
And after that? Shi Qiang asked.
A second enlightenment. A second renaissance. A second French Revolution. You can find all that stuff in the history books. Luo Ji turned back in surprise. The predictions he had made to Zhuang Yan 2 centuries before had come to pass. A second French Revolution? In France? No, that's just a saying. It was the entire world. After the revolution, the new national governments terminated their space strategies and poured their attention into improving people's lives. And then critical technology emerged. Genetic engineering and fusion technology were harnessed for large-scale food production, ending the age of weather-dependent food. From then on, the world would no longer be hungry. Everything moved quickly after that. There were fewer people, after all, and in the space of just 2 decades, life returned to pre-Great Ravine levels. Then Golden Age levels were restored. People had set their hearts on this road of comfort, and no one wanted to go back. There's another term you might find interesting, Dr. Luo, said the first neighbour, drawing closer to him. An economist before hibernation, he had a deeper understanding of the issues. It's called civilization immunity. It means that when the world has suffered a serious illness, it triggers civilization's immune system, so that something like the early crisis era won't happen again. Humanism comes first, and perpetuating civilization comes second. These are the concepts that today's society is based on. And after that? Luo Ji asked.
After that came the freaky stuff, Shi Xiaoming grew excited. Originally, the countries of the world had planned to live in peace and push the trisolar crisis onto the back burner. But what do you think happened?
There was swift progress everywhere. Technology sped forward and broke through all the technical obstacles that had stood in the way of space strategy before the Great Ravine, one after the other.
That's not freaky, Luoji said. Emancipation of human nature inevitably brings with it scientific and technological progress.
After about half a century of peace following the Great Ravine, the world turned its thoughts back to the Trisolaran invasion and felt it ought to reconsider the war. With humanity's power now on a completely different plane than before the Great Ravine, a global state of war was again declared and construction was begun on a space fleet. But unlike the first time, national constitutions were clear about one thing. Resource expenditure for the space strategy had to be kept within a specified range and must not have a disastrous impact on the world economy and on community life. And that's when the space fleets became independent countries.
You don't actually have to think about any of this, though, the economist said. From now on, just think about how to live a good life. That old revolutionary slogan is just an adaptation of the old saying from the Golden Age. Make time for life, or life won't make time. To new life.
When they had drained their last glass, Luoji praised the economist for putting things so well. Now his mind had space only for Zhuang Yan and the child. He wanted to get settled as soon as possible, and then go wake them.
Make time for civilization. Make time for life.